Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is the Reason Podcast. My guests today are Reason Magazine Editor-in-Chief Catherine Mangu Ward and Reason Editor-at-Large Matt Welch, and we'll be talking about Barack Obama's farewell speech, Donald Trump's inauguration, and the larger phenomenon of presidential derangement syndromes. Catherine, Matt, thanks for coming out today.
Thank you.
Hi, Nick.
All right, so let's get to it. One of the big stories coming out over the weekend concerns the number of Democratic members of Congress who are boycotting Trump's swearing-in on Friday. The Washington Post puts the number at over 40 so far, and it includes people like Keith Ellison from Minnesota and most famously John Lewis of Georgia. Catherine, does this kind of public display of dissing of the incoming president worry you at all? Or is this a story, or is this the kind of fake news story we're going to be dealing with for the next 4 to 40 years?
I mean, John Lewis boycotted George W. Bush's inauguration as well. So I think it's probably at the very least worth putting it in context that John Lewis basically doesn't like to attend the inaugurations of Republicans. Which, fair enough, I also do not like to attend the inaugurations.
Republicans,
as they shall henceforth be known. You know, it's a rich opportunity to grab yourself a headline. And I would argue that there that old adage about there's no more dangerous place in Washington than between a camera and, it used to be Chuck Schumer, maybe John Lewis.
Yeah, I don't know about that, because his most famous photo spread, of course, is him being bloodied after being beaten by white supremacists and
cops.
Yes,
so that was a really dangerous place to be. I stand by it.
Yeah, okay, you got that. Matt, Lewis called Trump illegitimate not simply because he didn't win the popular vote, but because of Russian meddling in the election. That's pretty screwed up, isn't it? Especially if we are... Yeah, if all of us and all of us good, decent, clean-smelling Americans are worried about, the lack of decorum and the overt partisanship, is this?
I mean, I don't give a rat's patootie about a lack of decorum in general, but I think that even and especially from an anti-Trump or a Trump-phobic standpoint, to call his presidency illegitimate is kind of you're giving up half of the fight. You're advertising your belief or your disbelief in American institutions, such as the institution that guarantees nobody is hacking into what happens in the voting booth. Again, we still have no credible evidence that the evil Ruskies, and they're evil and they're Ruskies, got in between what I did and the ballot that I was marking off my very important New York votes for Gary Johnson for. So when you start running down the legitimacy of all of those democratic institutions, you know what? You need those democratic institutions if you are going to withstand the coming authoritarian winter. So maybe stop running them down. I mean, boycotting an inauguration. What's wrong with calling it not going, as Catherine is doing, yeah, and I'm doing, and other people are doing as well? I think that's totally fine, whatever. But going after serially, and you pointed out this, Nick, in one of your blog posts, this ain't new. You know, John Lewis, I think Kevin Williamson had a point about, like, John Lewis and John McCain are both, like, great American heroes who are capable of talking bollocks. I think Lewis described McCain in 2008 as reminding him of George Wallace. There's a lot of things that John McCain reminds us of, and that just ain't one of them. There are heroes out there in the world, and when they become congressmen and senators for the rest of their lives, they're capable of cloaking themselves into their heroism. But the election was legitimate. You need to shore up whatever institutions were so weak that some penny ante Macedonian hacking from 16-year-olds is somehow going to affect the vote. That is that's the worst advertisement for American broad weakness that I've seen in a long time, if that's even remotely true.
Catherine,
I also want to stick up for clearly the right response if you don't like Trump's election and inauguration is the response of the Women's March, right? It's show up and holler about it a bit. I mean, I'm fine with the other approach, which is I'm a famous person, people expect to be there, and I'm going to show my disapproval by not being there. But again, in the spirit of, hey, let's enjoy our bulwarks against tyranny while we have them, let's all go holler at the president, like Catherine, the founders intended.
Are you hoping that Trump wears a top hat and brings that back into fashion to kind of close the broken circuit when Kennedy refused to wear a top hat in 1960?
Yes, I am. I'm also, I guess, while we're sort of casting back to various inaugurations, do you think it's too much to hope for a case of pneumonia in a very short presidency?
Oh, man.
Wow, that is...
Call the Secret Service.
Yeah, that is really... of course, Trump will be older than William Henry Harrison as well. So this is a historic moment.
And, you know, that point...
70
out
is the new 50.
That points out actually another bit of ridiculousness coming around, or hysteria coming from Democrats right now, are the people who are like, yeah, but Mike Pence, he's the real problem. It's like, you know what? You got to identify what your real problem is here. Just because Mike Pence may or may not have expressed some knuckle-dragging, socially conservative view on this or that kind of thing. Like, if you're going to be saying that we're right in the, you know, riding our way into incipient fascism, don't just point to the next warm-blooded Republican and say, no, but he's the real fascist. I remember this very, and Nikki, I'm sure you do too, in the late 80s. When George H.W. Bush was going to become the president, everyone's like, who had been spending the last 8 years talking about how Ronnie Reagan was a fascist? I mean, every single moment of those 8 years, suddenly in 1988 said, well, no, the real problem is George H.W. Bush.
Well, he had run the CIA. He was in deep with China, and Dan Quayle was waiting in the way. It might be that people from Indiana are the real problem.
I want to kind of stick up for the never pencers a little bit
because
I do. First of all, that's a thing. That is a thing. So let's pause and enjoy that. But, I think there are people who legitimately are very focused on the sort of social conservative agenda that they perceive to be Pence is kind of the avatar of that.
Right.
I think it's a different question than the legitimacy question. Right. Like, people are worried about Trump because he might, like, wake up tomorrow and say there are no more elections, or like nuke the world. People are worried about Pence because he might do the thing Republicans have been kind of saying maybe they're going to do as promises to Christian conservatives, but never actually done.
Well, this is the question.
And I think that's a legitimate fear.
Yeah, I mean, because to be honest, I'm not, well, I guess it's been settled in the courts, but, Pence, in his last State of the State address as a governor of Indiana, said that he would veto any legislation that extended anti-discrimination statutes in the state to gay and lesbian marriages, and I guess also workplace rules. And he's very anti-abortion. And this is a really kind of fascinating question for me with the abortion stuff, because that's a lot where a lot of the anti-Trump animus ends up landing. It's less about anything he says in particular and more that he's going to be the one who will actually create, he'll push through some kind of right to life amendment or life begins at the moment of conception type of thing. Even though that's one of those places where, a vast majority of Americans, 60% or more, like the abortion laws we have in place. They, if they're asked directly, is Roe versus Wade okay? Leaving it completely up to the woman in the first trimester, a vast majority of Americans are okay with that. Where do you guys think, and this is also something with the Republicans, that's also true about immigration. A majority of people, even including a slim majority of Republicans, favor a legal path to a path to legal status, if not citizenship, for current illegal immigrants. How does a party that is so out of step with, a large majority of Americans, you can throw in pot legalization into this as well, why do they stick with those issues? Because it seems like they're electoral losers.
Well, it's self-evidently not an electoral loser, Donald Trump this year. He ran on what, Bill Clinton ran on in 1996. The Democratic Party was basically sounding exactly like Donald Trump did in this election, maybe not calling them rapists per se, but seriously, it was, go back and look at the Democratic Party platform in 96. It's like, we have no border. It's a sieve. The criminals are crossing and they're committing heinous crimes and then going back. It's a joke, all this kind of stuff. Trump is very canny about identifying areas where politicians from either party have made have provided lip service, have talked about it, but haven't really accomplished or promised what they said. I've been looking at back statements and video of Democratic politicians. I mean, Barack Obama said he was going to renegotiate NAFTA on day one. And of course he didn't, because they mm-hmm. never do. Well, Trump identifies those things that they say and never do. And he says them and a bunch of other stuff in such a way that makes you believe that he will be the first and only one.
Do you think he will do them?
No. I mean, in this case, I think that he will extend the Obama, the first term Obama presidency strategy or policy emphasis on deporting criminals. And he said this since being elected, that they're going to identify the criminals, deport them first. Build a big, beautiful wall, which will have absolutely nothing to do with 47% or 53% of illegal immigrants coming into this country. And then they'll see what happens. So he's going to deport criminals, which is what they said before. They're going to try to go after sanctuary cities, but they're not going to be able to do that probably because of the Supreme Court decision written by Antonin Scalia, of all people, back
in Nino. Reminding me that he really could have used my pillow, because the fill would have stayed the way he wanted it, and maybe he wouldn't have expired the way that he did with the pillow on top of him.
That took me a while to get, Nick, to be honest.
I'm sorry. Catherine, what about this question of illegitimacy of the election? Is that going? Do you think that's going to be the main kind of thorn in the side of Trump, that, you know, whether or not people believe it, Democrats seem like, or Trump opponents are going to be harping on that again and again. And it raises a couple of questions. First is, who got to Bill Weld then? What country got to Bill Weld and turned him from being a Gary Johnson supporter into a Hillary Clinton supporter? And what about all of the cases where the United States has meddled in other elections? And I'm not talking about coups or anything. There's recent academic research between 1946 and 2000, for instance, at least 81 times the U.S. government used propaganda or news media to kind of push particular candidates in elections, including Obama saying, you know, visiting Berlin a few years ago and saying, oh, if I were German, I'd vote for Angela Merkel. You know, what is this meddling charge going to stick?
I think that, you know, if you cast your mind back to Bush v. Gore and the sort of, I think, much better grounded idea that that election was, you know, stolen, dubious, shady. I mean, in the end, I think, you know, the person who actually won the election took office. But it was understandable at the time that an awful lot of people felt like, you know, we was robbed. Mm. And the Trump election is very clearly it's more unambiguously legitimate than that one was. And but I remember during the entire two terms of George W. Bush, people still saying, you know,
not my
it should
president.
Have been Al Gore. Al Gore
selected.
Was my president.
He
not
wasn't elected. He was selected.
He was selected. So, yeah, I think that this is going to hang around. I think the vague overlay of like Ruski meddling paired with Trump's totally inappropriate buddy buddy relationship with Putin is a little clusterfuck of his own making. And I think it will take on more strength if he starts doing additional seemingly illegitimate things, right? I mean, if he just does business as usual, this will fade. And if he starts sort of subverting the way that people perceive ordinary business should be done in Washington, it's going to strengthen.
Well, let's, Matt, to kind of pursue that into Obama saying farewell, and he, according to TMZ, which is, I think, yet to be wrong about anything in its short history.
That's right.
The Obamas are leaving the White House, and they're going to vacation. I don't know what a vacation is, but vacation in Palm Springs, California.
They're going on vacation with Spock.
Yeah. well, I guess Obama was a Vulcan, right? Wasn't that part? He was no drama Obama. He said in his farewell speech, our democracy is threatened whenever we take it for granted. And he also urged Americans to help rebuild our democratic institutions as if like the election, you know, that happened did not follow according to constitutional directives. I mean, but is he into something about, you know, like what do we do to rebuild the democratic institutions, especially when you have large numbers of Democrats boycotting the inauguration, calling Trump illegitimate? You know, is it just having demonstrations? What has to happen, and should something happen to kind of rebuild a sense of democracy, which went missing in a lot of ways? When, you know, Obama was going on and on about his pen and his phone and acting unilaterally because he had to. What should come next? And is Trump the person to bring it?
We already are crashing on the rocky shores of the word democracy and what that means. And insert, you know, we're not a democracy, we're a republic, annoying libertarian now. Let's just call him Camille Foster. But he's right. He's the wrong messenger. And it's not democracy. It's, I would say, more our institutions or civic institutions as much as any other type of institutions. You can't, if you're worrying about authoritarianism, we can't go authoritarian unless people voluntarily start giving up stuff. Stop participating, stop having a free and robust press, stop, you know, keeping it real according to their own lights. Stop having, you know, if suddenly Trump started packing the Supreme Court, pulling some FDR things, it's going to be really hard. I mean, working for the LA Times, I'm not going to compare the LA Times exactly to the federal government, but there are some similarities here. You go in thinking that you're going to totally uproot and change this longstanding, very bloated institution, and you're just not. I mean, but people have found this out to their chagrin all over the corporate world. It's really a pain in the rear to try to deal with these hidebound types of places. I find it fascinating that Donald Trump is, he's talking a completely different game than what we've seen on issues like European integration, on NATO, on trade. And he keeps reiterating these things in all kinds of interviews, including with the Times of London, which is just a fascinating, totally incoherent read. And he's doing this at the same time that the people that he's nominated to the positions to carry out his wishes and policies are saying the exact opposite in their confirmation hearings.
Do you see that as a sign of incoherence or a sign of strength? Because one of the arguments is that somebody like Trump, as a good CEO, he appoints or he hires and puts into a position of decision-making power somebody who is who's good at what they do, and then he lets them do it. Or is he? Mattis, who was saying, "Oh no, Russia is a really big problem for us." Trump is riding, you know, bareback with Putin around poppy field somewhere.
It could very well be a position of strength and confidence. It could also be a reflection, and this kind of goes back to the Obama premise. The question that there isn't a bench of people who think in a like-minded way. And the way this relates to Obama is there's a big story out in GQ today, a profile of the post-Obama presidency. And we're going to be having to read all this crap for forever. Obama is going to become what Reagan was to Republicans, except perhaps without the actual record to back it up. But he's going to become this figure of longing and ache on which everyone projects their own fantasies about what his presidency actually was compared to what it was. But there isn't any other Democrats. And so Trump has kind of a similar problem. There aren't. What's he going to do? Have Dana Rohrabacher be his Secretary of State? That's just not going to work. And as the hearings themselves proved with the cross-examinations from senators, many of whom were just hysterical about absolutely every issue that you can imagine, the culture of Washington isn't the culture of Trump. And so there's not enough warm bodies out there to enact his exact very strange point of view. And lastly, just the incoherent word just has to do, as much as anything else, with the way that he answers questions. I mean, from the beginning of a paragraph to the end of the paragraph, you have no idea what planet the man's on, which is weird. I mean, it's going to be an interesting strategic thing with the decider in chief being someone who is acting in a very stream of consciousness, making it up as he's going along type of thing, in which, you know, in the same breath, you can talk about how Afghanistan is a huge disaster. We've been at war for 17 years. It doesn't make any sense. And then at the end of the paragraph, he's like, well, that's because we're not allowing our soldiers to win. So we're going to win harder next time. It's like, what are you even talking about? I think that is gives a sense of unease to people, because it's just he's unpredictable. You don't know where he's going or what he's thinking, and you don't know how it's going to interact with the people that he's appointed who think differently than he does.
Yeah,
this is really like on display in the Times interview.
And this is the Times of London.
The Times of London,
Matt
yes.
hipped us to, which check it out. It's like timeslondon.co.uk. Go ahead, Catherine, because it is pretty fascinating. Kind of a word salad of something.
Yeah, so they released an unedited transcript, obviously, to insulate themselves against any charges of finagling his words. But the sample question, why do you think Brexit happened? And it starts with Trump negotiating down what day one means for his presidency. So he says, one of the first orders I'm going to sign, day one, which I'll consider to be Monday as opposed to Friday or Saturday, right? I mean, day one's going to be Monday because I don't want to get it mixed up with the celebrations. Anyway, so then there's that bit. Then there's a little Syria bit. And then we wind up with, by the way, I love Germany. My father came from Germany. the end. And then, like a little bit further down in the interview, he says, well, one thing that makes him German is that he has a real love of order and he likes strength. Right. So this is like they toss him this gentle little softball of, you know, why Brexit? And he just goes full free association.
Although, I mean, it is true. The interview is conducted by a Brit and a German, and the German at various points is like, what do you think about being part German? And it is, I would think as
But Trump introduces that, right? Like,
no,
Trump
I
is the one
that.
That's like, let's talk about my German
ethnicity.
What
can you say about Germany without being like, you know what, they still have a lot to answer for? You know, one way or the other.
You could say one thing I love about Germany is the modern Germany, where they're so scared of their own shadows because they're very, very sorry about the Holocaust. I love that about Germany, that they're now very sorry for being German.
I like the Lederhosen, although that has bad connotations as well, I guess. Well, you know, this
he
all
also says, just to interject, yes. Nick, he also says in there that the EU was partially created so that Germany could beat America in trade. And this is a really interesting, I think, misreading of the foundation of the EU, or I should say the EEC or the EC beforehand. Right. The European Common Market was in large part a co-creation of the core partners of Europe, Germany and France being the most important
and
ones.
And the Benelux nations, of course.
And the Beneluxers and the United States. And the idea was from the U.S. point of view that if those people are trading with one another in a free system, then that way we're not going to have the Soviet Union make incursions, both just in terms of being attractive to domestic political parties in Western Europe, and also actually coming in
by the
and
same
installing
token. Though, that's you know, the common market is, you know, the 1950s really, and then when you get to the modern European Union, you're talking you know, post-Soviet, really the late 90s, and there's no question that Germany and to a lesser degree France and England had emerged as dominant economic powerhouses. So
right,
and Germany certainly was the guy behind the euro.
The concept to look at Europe and the institutions that bind it together, whatever you think about those institutions, and to posit that they were set up in such a way in order to compete against, perhaps unfairly, the United States, is a completely different interpretation of the transatlantic relationship than anyone who's been having the transatlantic relationship for 70 years. And that's actually pretty interesting.
I agree. And, you know, one of the things that I find genuinely kind of fascinating, and I don't know if it's disturbing or not, but about Trump is that he doesn't seem to have any interest or knowledge of history before about 1970. You know, he's mentioned, oh, his favorite general is George Patton, which is scary. But, I mean, everybody knows that he's saying that because he saw the movie. You know, and he probably thinks that George C. Scott is Patton, which, you know, more power to him for that. But it is strange that he does not seem to have any interest or knowledge or depth in anything before his, you know, adolescence or something like that.
Although people said that about George W. too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they said.
Oh, and
oh,
I think Obama
so
as well.
Literate.
Yeah, Obama never. I mean, you know, for all of people talking about Obama's elegiac rhetoric and his biblical sounding phrases, he never actually quotes. You know, he doesn't quote any literature. He doesn't quote any Bible verses. It just sounds like it, and he doesn't.
You want a president with better footnotes?
You know what? I would like a president, and I think Bush showed that he did actually read. And Reagan, you know, he had kind of a cracked history of things, but he actually talked about history. And I think You know, older I mean, you know, there is a kind of presentism, I think, in American foreign policy and American domestic policy that is deeply troubling. Because, and this, Matt, if I can pick a bit of a fight with you about some of this, and Catherine, I'm not sure where you are on this, but, you know, when we talk about the Ruskies, I mean, like all of us, and I say this as a man who spent yesterday watching Gymkhana, the Kurt Thomas movie, which is a Cold War thriller in which a gymnast who was not allowed to compete in Moscow because of the Olympic boycott finally gets to kick the ass of a bunch of in a fake a Stan country. But like we're still trapped in the idea of the Soviet or of Russia as the Soviet Union and Europe as like in the same position it was in 1980 as opposed to now, because shouldn't, and this is where I think Trump's presentism opens up some weird and interesting possibilities when he says, you know, NATO is obsolete, or it needs to be rethought and reconfigured. Isn't that true? I mean, Russia is a Putin is a horrible dictator, tyrant, all of that, but we're not living in the Soviet era.
Well, there's the thing that's similar to the Soviet era, or that's resonant of it, is that the head of Russia laments the demise of the Soviet era and wants to restore some of what was lost because of the whittling down of the Soviet Union into the Russian Federation. And that's with us. And he's acting in an expansionist, war-like way in his near abroad and has been for 15, 20 years. And so, you know, that's a strategic threat out there to the peace of Europe and of just to the hopeful kind of world sense of taboos that you shouldn't be swallowing up your other countries. I mean, there's always a case that NATO is obsolete and that out of date and all this kind of stuff when you when it gets very much further afield from the core mission of the people, the countries that join NATO will not be attacked and they won't attack each other for the most part. In that sense, the alliance has been a complete success because people don't fuck with a NATO country. That is the ultimate reason for NATO. Trump argues that NATO is, he has a couple of different arguments for why it's obsolete. One is that people aren't paying enough money in it. Another is that it's useless on terror, which is an interesting kind of reading of it. I think he's kind of conflating that just with the Angela Merkel of policies of immigration, refugees and things like that. Mm-hmm. Although who knows exactly what he's saying. NATO.
Well, it's also that terror is a bigger threat than Russian expansionism. Russia is not pushing into Germany. Russia is not pushing into Poland, et cetera. So,
correct.
But it is bombing. NATO is bombing Libya, right?
Is NATO bombing Libya right now?
That was the military group that actually bombed Libya, that we the kinetic right. motion that we led from behind.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the point of NATO should be binding people in a common defense and making sure that they're not, and part of that common defense is making sure they're not going to war with one another, right. Even though Turkey and Greece obviously have been nipping at each other's faces for a long time. And that's the sense of Europe that's been lost, of that. This is not just to be this kind of block that's, you know, steadfast against the other, whether that's us or whether that's the Soviet Union or whatever. Mm. It's also to make sure that Germany and France and England just stop shooting each other in the face, which they've done throughout their entire history, except for after World War II. It's a hard sell to make because people get tired of that story. It's old. And NATO does go far afield. There are sclerotic institutions. Every single, you know, anything that succeeds for any length of time, however you define success, even just existing, is going to add layers of pointlessness to it and expense. And that's been true of NATO for at least 20 years, even as it has been expanded.
Catherine, do you in the London of Times interview or Times of London, London of Times, London Fog, Times of London interview, do you find legitimate reasons to indulge in Trump derangement syndrome?
I don't. I mean, I think there are plenty of legitimate reasons to indulge in Trump derangement syndrome, but there's nothing groundbreaking in this interview. It's just him being Donald Trump. I think the idea that this is where he's landed as he steps into the office, and it's still highly incoherent. It's still very kind of self-indulgent and highly personalized. I mean, his answer to the very first question is about his golf course that he owns in Scotland. You know, none of that is auspicious, but this interview, at least, doesn't contain reasons for my variant of Trump derangement syndrome, which is to fear that he will undermine sort of the larger institutions that will allow us to peacefully and successfully replace him when the time comes. That's the place to worry, and yeah. I go back and forth on that.
Do you have any faith that Congress, and we've written about this at Reason and across all of our platforms and whatnot, or talked about it, there's a number of Republican Congress people who are saying, okay, you know what, not necessarily in favor of Trump, but you know, it's time that Congress, after taking a beating first under Bush and then under Obama, where the executive branch pulled more and more power into it, that Congress is now really going to assert its primacy in lawmaking and budget setting. Do you buy that, or is that kind of paper tiger talk?
Yeah. So I like the idea of the Article One Project. I like the idea that maybe Congress will reassert its role as a checker and balancer of the president. But I think ultimately this is just us being hopeful in the same way that we always are, that this will be the time that, you know, we find a way to structurally build in some restraint of the growth of government. In fact, they're all Republicans. They're going to figure out a way to get along.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm hoping for the deep state to be the checker and balancer at this point. I think that's what
we're seeing, right?
I mean, God. Talk a little bit about that, because you had mentioned before Madison passing and people like Rex Tillerson and whatnot. I mean, it's, you know, and I mean, we've got a situation where the intelligence community and Donald Trump, you know, the president-elect, are at open war with each other, which is, I don't know if it's unprecedented, but it certainly is kind of strange.
It's unprecedented. I've never seen such a thing. I mean, the intelligence community as it exists is a post-World War II creation.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe this is another sign that the world that we've come to expect after World War II is being challenged. And this puts me in the awkward position of even though I disagree with Trump comparing the CIA several times to Nazi Germany, I think that's probably
if only because the Nazis were much better dressed, right? I mean, you look at people like Aldrich Ames. I mean, he was wearing off the rack clothing, for Christ's sake.
I think the Nazis had better intel, just based on that report about RT that the CIA barfed up towards us. No, we've never seen anything like this. And part of this is that the intelligence agencies, the CIA in particular, they have acted without much in the way of oversight for 60 plus years.
Yeah.
And now they're having someone who's openly challenging them. And it's creepy when Chuck Schumer says, hey, don't tangle these guys, you know, something bad's going to happen to you. And it's creepy to hear that.
You know, what's interesting too, is that Trump, I mean, the other moment where the kind of post-war intelligence community operation, and maybe even the larger military industrial complex, was challenged was during the 70s with the Church Commission hearings. And that was by people who were against it. Trump is not saying he's against a surveillance state or, you know, intelligence that vacuums up everything about everybody in the world, including Americans. He's saying that they suck at it, that they're not good, which is, in a way, is a more I find myself cold with that kind of criticism, but it's actually a more effective critique, I think.
There's semi precedent for this, not in the public sense as much, but at least if you believe the serial liar Bob Woodward, Ronald Reagan tried to take on the CIA via Bill Casey and reorganize the way that they operate and funnel their information and produce things. And part of that was based on the sense that they had gone rogue and needed to be reined in. So this has happened. That was more behind closed doors than it was open warfare like this is. But that's just bizarre. And I think we're going to see different versions of this play out in a lot of bureaucracies, because Trump has appointed in a half a dozen at least of his cabinet positions people who are there to upset the apple cart of the bureaucracies. Betsy DeVos at Education, who's coming up for her hearings now, being primary among them. And so to the extent of which the bureaucracies themselves, and the EPA is another example, Pruitt.
Yeah.
These bureaucracies, people who've been, they've been doing business like X for decades. There hasn't been actually that much daylight probably between the George W. Bush Department of Education and the Barack Obama Department of Education. And so they're going to suddenly see someone who's hostile to the institution, and they're going to be coming out and trying to leak everything as much as possible. So I think we're going to have a very robust sense. Jack Schaefer had a column yesterday that was pretty good about how this is going to be some golden era for journalism. And part of the reason is that you have these very motivated bureaucracies who want to dish dirt on the incoming hordes.
Full of leakers. Yeah. Everybody's a leaker now. Well, yeah. I mean, clearly the most instructive piece of literature on this question is Yes Minister, right? It's time for all of us to rewatch Yes Minister, Yes Prime Minister,
yeah,
which features a sort of, rogue bureaucracy running the government. And I suppose that for those who are concerned about Trump, it could be kind of a comforting.
So let's to kind of close out this conversation on an up note, hopefully anyway. I had asked Matt and Catherine to come up with at least one thing, one positive development outside of politics, and I'm going to go first here. And for me, it's something that our Reasons TV critic Glenn Garvin has talked about, and other people have widely noted. Peter Suderman also at Reason had written about this too. And for me, the positive thing is the massive proliferation of great television on all sorts of different channels and streaming services and whatnot. I just caught up with The Young Pope, HBO's limited edition series with Jude Law as a 47-year-old pope named Lenny Bilardo, from who had been Archbishop of New York and the Cardinal of the New York Diocese. It's a fascinating, weird show. It's only had two episodes so far. But beyond that, a couple of weeks ago, I binged on the second season of Man in the High Castle, which I thought was fantastic and is perfectly pitched for our time, because it's all about imagining alternate realities that you can use either to hide out from reality or to change the reality you're in. And it seems to me that we're entering a hinge point where we need to start kind of imagining alternate realities that we want to create. And in many ways, we're doing that in all sorts of ways, whether you're talking about the Free State Project or you're talking about, Catherine, you had mentioned the Women's March on Washington, which will happen on Saturday the 21st. But I mean, you know, people are really motivated to start experiments in living. And I think that's reflected in the massive amount of great TV, weird TV, different TV that we're able to do. So for me, that's the one thing that's making me feel good about stuff. Matt, do you have a particular development?
Yeah. When in doubt, talk about baseball. The Baseball Hall of Fame vote is going to be announced in the next couple of days here, which is the Baseball Writers Association of America, who traditionally have been a nest of blinkered fools and half-wits, which is only a little bit unfair. What's interesting about the process is they're going to probably name, I guess, maybe three people will be inducted. You have to get 75% of the vote of voting members. But what's happened over the last few years is that, led by outsider weirdos on the internet, they have kind of pushed a transparency expectation onto the writers. They had a secret ballot for years. It's still a secret ballot. You don't have to share. But these people, they wanted to make arguments with the gatekeepers who were deciding who's good and who's not. And what that has done has led to a lot of super interesting public conversations. And it's changed the behavior and changed the voting and changed the argumentation of the people who are making the vote in ways that I think have been beneficial and fascinating to watch, and without any heavy hand coming out and saying, do this.
Who do you want to see in the Hall of Fame on their first ballot?
Who's on the first ballot this year? Vladimir Guerrero, I wouldn't mind, just to help clear out the backlog, if nothing else. And I'm more excited about people Tim Raines. He's on the last year, and it looks like he's going to get in. And that's largely, he's been championed by the people who are outside of the institution, making more kind of sabermetric arguments about why he belongs. And it's part of that push and pull that has led to this thing happening.
How many expos are in the hall? They've got to be one of the least represented franchises, right?
I think Raines would become the first main expo. Andre Dawson.
Gary Carter's in, isn't he?
Gary Carter, more so, expos than Detroit Tigers.
Do you think Bobby Gritch will ever get in?
Eventually, he will when people start remembering how important the mustache was to American masculinity in the 1970s.
It kept us going there when the lights were going out all over Europe. So, Catherine, what about you? Obviously, you're a big baseball fan.
Fell asleep there for a minute, so sorry if I missed anything.
So, what is anything positive outside of politics for you, or is it all a valley of ashes?
This is adjacent to politics, but it's still generally cheerful. This morning, Liz Nolan Brown, Reason associate editor, decided that she wanted to have for the Women's March. All of these people are making pussy hats. They're making little pink crocheted hats with ears on them. And she said,
hate to be this gynecological necessarily, but why is that a pussy hat? Just because it's pink and has ears?
Because it's the pun on the word pussy, which means two things, Nick Gillespie.
Yeah, I get that. I just don't,
Keep going, Catherine, please.
Yeah. Okay. They just want to remind the world as they march around in Washington, D.C. that the word pussy was central to this election. And Liz decided she would like to own a red one that says Make America Great again on it, which would subvert all of the expectations about these hats, and immediately went searching online, and it exists. So that's what I want to share, is that people have found a way to buy and sell this unlikely item in the world. And this is an idea that people had only at Thanksgiving. So congratulations, Etsy.
Yeah,
and consumerism for making that possible.
It is pretty amazing. We live in a world of almost instantaneous creation and gratification, right? It's
instantaneous creation of markets. Also, yeah. I mean, right?
And
this
hope,
is not just you got to know somebody who can make you this hat.
Do they have one in a hypoallergenic lamb's wool or something like that, or
of hemp? I'm sure there are vegan pussy hats for sure. Yeah, yeah, definitely. So right. God bless America and its hats.
Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Catherine Mangu Ward. She is the editor in chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for chatting today.
Thank you.
And with Matt Welch, editor-at-large, calling from his bunker in somewhere in Brooklyn, New York, which has gone from being a socially conservative borough of churches and gin mills to being ground zero in the Trump-hating club. Matt, thank you for joining us.
All of their cousins moved to Staten Island and vote for Trump.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, it's easier to cordon them off there. You just have to stop the, the ferry service, and you'll never hear from them again. They'll flood into New Jersey then.
That's de Blasio's second term.
Well, and I am Nick Gillespie, and this has been the Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe to us at iTunes. Rate and review us while you're there. Never miss an episode. Thanks for listening.